Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here.
Reminding you that a lot of life's firsts are better with help from American Family Insurance.
Like your first home expansion.
Or your first big lightning strike.
There's a first for everything. Get the right home policy at the right price with the right help from American Family's agents.
Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Chapter 6 of Tom Sawyer Abroad. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Tom Sawyer Abroad, Chapter 6. It's a caravan. I was so weak that the only thing I wanted was a chance to lay down, so I made straight for my locker bunk and stretched myself out there. But a body couldn't get back his strength in no such oven as that, so Tom gave the command to soar, and Jim started her aloft. We had to go up a mile before we struck comfortable weather where it was breezy and pleasant and just right, and pretty soon I was all straight again. Tom had been sitting quiet and thinking, but now he jumps up and says, "I bet you 1,000 to 1 I know where we are. We're in the Great Sahara as sure as guns." He was so excited he couldn't hold still, but I wasn't. I says, "Well, then, where's the Great Sahara? In England or in Scotland?" "'Tain't in either. It's in Africa." Jim's eyes bugged out, and he begun to stare down with no end of interest, because that was where his originals come from. But I didn't more than half believe it. I couldn't, you know. It seemed too awful far away for us to have traveled. But Tom was full of his discovery, as he called it, and said the lions and the sand meant the great desert, sure. He said he could have found out, before we sighted land, that we was crowding the land somewheres, if he hadn't thought of one thing, and when we asked him what, he said, "These clocks. They're chronometers. You always read about them sea voyages. One of them is keeping Greenwich time, and the other is keeping St. Louis time, like my watch. When we left St. Louis, it was 4 in the afternoon, by my watch and this clock, and it was 10 at night by this Greenwich clock. Well, at this time of the year, the sun sets at about 7 o'clock. Now, I noticed the time yesterday evening when the sun went down, and it was 5:30 by the Greenwich clock, and 11:30 a.m. by my watch and the other clock. You see, the sun rose and set by my watch in St. Louis, and the Greenwich clock was 6 hours fast. But we've come so far east that it comes within less than 1/2 hour of setting by the Greenwich clock now. And I'm away out, more than 4 hours and a half out. You see, that meant that we was closing up on the longitude of Ireland, and would strike it before long if we was pinted right, which we wasn't. No, sir, we've been a-wandering way down south of east, and it's my opinion we are in Africa. Look at this map. You see how the shoulder of Africa sticks out to the west? Think how fast we've traveled. If we had gone straight east, we would be long past England by this time. You watch for noon, all of you, and we'll stand up. And when we can't cast a shadow, we'll find that this Greenwich clock is coming mighty close to marking 12. Yes, sir, I think we're in Africa, and it's just bully. Jim was gazing down with a glass. He shook his head and says, "Marse Tom, I reckon dey's a mistake somers. Ain't seen no niggers yet." "That's nothing. They don't live in the desert. What is that, way off yonder? Give me a glass." He took a long look and said it was like a black string stretched across the sand, but he couldn't guess what it was. "Well," I says, "I reckon maybe you've got a chance now to find out whereabouts this balloon is, because as like as not that is one of these lines here that's on the map that you call meridians of longitude, and we can drop down and look at its number, and—" "Oh, shucks, Huck Finn, I never see such a lunkhead as you. Do you suppose there's meridians of longitude on the earth?" "Tom Sawyer, they're set down on the map, and you know it perfectly well, and here they are, and you can see for yourself." "Of course they're on the map, but that's nothing. There ain't any on the ground." "Tom, do you know that to be so?" "Certainly I do." "Well, then, that map's a liar again. I never see such a liar as that map." He fired up at that, and I was ready for him. And Jim was warming his opinion, too,
and next minute we'd have broke loose on another argument if Tom hadn't dropped the glass and begun to clap his hands like a maniac and sing out, "Camels! Camels!" So I grabbed glass and Jim, too, and took a look, but I was disappointed and says, "Camels, your granny, they're spiders." "Spiders in a desert, you shad. Spiders walking in a procession. You don't ever reflect, Huck Finn, and I reckon you really haven't got anything to reflect with. Don't you know we're as much as a mile up in the air and that that string of crawlers is 2 or 3 miles away? Spiders, good land. Spiders as big as a cow. Perhaps you'd like to go down and milk one of them. But they're camels just the same. It's a caravan, that's what it is. It's a mile long. Well, then, let's go down and look at it. I don't believe in it, and ain't going to, till I see it and know it." "All right," he says, and give the command. "Lower away." As we come slanting down into the hot weather, we could see that it was camels, sure enough, plodding along, an everlasting string of them, with bales strapped to them, and several hundred men in long white robes, and a thing like a shawl bound over their heads and hanging down with tassels and fringes. And some of the men had long guns, and some hadn't, and some was riding, and some was walking, and the weather, well, it was just roasting. And how slow they did creep along. We swooped down now, all of a sudden, and stopped about 100 yards over their heads. The men all set up a yell, and some of them fell flat on their stomachs. Some begun to fire their guns at us, and the rest broke and scampered every which way, and so did the camels. We see that we was making trouble, so we went up again about a mile to the cool weather, and watched them from there. It took them an hour to get together and form the procession again. Then they started along, but we could see by the glasses that they wasn't paying much attention to anything but us. We poked along, looking down at them with the glasses, and by we see a big sand mound, and something like people the other side of it. And there was something like a man laying on top of the mound that raised his head up every now and then, and seemed to be watching the caravan or us, we didn't know which. As the caravan got nearer, he sneaked down on the other side and rushed to the other men and horses, for that is what they was, and we see them mount in a hurry. And next, here they come like a house afire, some with lances and some with long guns, and all of them yelling the best they could. They come a-tearing down onto the caravan, and the next minute both sides crashed together and was all mixed up, and there was such another popping of guns as you never heard, and the air got so full of smoke you could only catch glimpses of them struggling together. There must have been 600 men in that battle, and it was terrible to see. Then they broke up into gangs and groups, fighting tooth and nail, and scurrying and scampering around and laying into each other like everything. And whenever the smoke cleared a little, you could see dead and wounded people and camels scattered far and wide and all about, and camels racing off in every direction. At last, the robbers see they couldn't win, so their chief sounded a signal, and all that was left of them broke away and went scampering across the plain. The last man to go snatched up a child and carried it off in front of him on his horse, and a woman run screaming and begging after him, and followed him away off across the plain till she was separated a long ways from her people. But it weren't no use, and she had to give it up, and we see her sink down on the sand and cover her face with her hands. Then Tom took the helm and started for that yahoo, and we come a-whizzing down and made a swoop and knocked him out of the saddle, child and all, and he was jarred considerable, but the child wasn't hurt, but laid there working its hands and legs in the air like a tumble-bug that's on its back and can't turn over. The man went staggering off to overtake his horse and didn't know what had hit him, for we was 300 or 400 yards up in the air by this time. We judged the woman would go and get the child now, but she didn't. We could see her, through the glass, still settin' there with her head bowed down on her knees, so of course she hadn't seen the performance and thought her child was clean gone with the man. She was nearly half a mile from her people, so we thought we might go down to the child, which was about 1/4 mile beyond her, and snake it to her before the caravan people could get to us to do us any harm. And besides, we reckoned they had enough business on their hands for one while, anyway, with the wounded. We thought we'd chance it, and we did. We swooped down and stopped, and Jim shinned down the ladder and fetched up the kid, which was a nice fat little thing, and in a noble good humor, too, considering it was just out of a battle and been tumbled off of a horse. And then we started for the mother, and stopped back of her and tolerable nearby, and Jim slipped down and crept up easy, and when he was close back of her, the child goo-gooed the way a child does, and she heard it, and whirled and fetched a shriek of joy, and made a jump for the kid and snatched it and hugged it and dropped it and hugged Jim, and then snatched off a gold chain and hung it around Jim's neck and hugged him again, and jerked up the child again, sobbing and glorifying all the time, and Jim, he shoved for the ladder and up it, and in a minute we was back up in the sky, and the woman was staring up with the back of her head between her shoulders, and the child with its arms locked around her neck. And there she stood, as long as we was in sight, a-sailing away in the sky. End of chapter 6. This is chapter 7 of Tom Sawyer Abroad. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Tom Sawyer Abroad by Mark Twain. Chapter 7. Tom Respects the Flea. "Noon," says Tom, and so it was. His shadder was just a blot around his feet. We looked, and the Greenwich clock was so close to 12 the difference didn't amount to nothing. So Tom said London was right north of us, or right south of us, one or t'other, and he reckoned by the weather and the sand and the camels it was north, and a good many miles north, too, as many as from New York to the City of Mexico, he guessed. Jim said he reckoned a balloon was a good deal the fastest thing in the world, unless it might be some kinds of birds, a wild pigeon maybe, or a railroad. But Tom said he had read about railroads in England going nearly 100 miles an hour for a little ways, and there never was a bird in the world that could do that, except one, and that was a flea.
A flea? Why, Mars Tom, in the first place, he ain't a bird, strictly speaking.
He ain't a bird, eh? Well, then, what is he?
I don't rightly know, Mars' Tom, but I expect he's only just an animal. No, I reckon that won't do nuther. He ain't big enough for an animal. He must be a bug. Yeah, so that's what he is. He's a bug.
I bet he ain't. But let it go. What's your second place?
Well, in second place, birds is critters that goes a long ways, but a flea don't.
He don't he? Come now, what is a long distance, if you know?
Why, it's miles and lots of 'em. Anybody knows that.
Can't a man walk miles?
Yes, sir, he can.
As many as a railroad?
Yes, sir, if you give him time.
Can't a flea?
Well, I suppose so, if you gives him heaps of time.
Now you begin to see, don't you, that distance ain't the thing to judge by at all. It's the time it takes to go the distance in that counts, ain't it?
Well, it do look sort of so, but I wouldn't have believed it, Mars Tom.
It's a matter of proportion, that's what it is. And when you come to gauge a thing's speed by its size, where's your bird and your man and your railroad alongside of a flea? The fastest man can't run more than about 10 miles in an hour, not much over 10,000 times his own length. But all the book says any common ordinary third-class flea can jump 150 times his own length. Yes, and he can make 5 jumps a second, too. 750 times his own length in 1 little second. For he don't fool away any time stopping and starting. He does them both at the same time. You'll see if you try to put your finger on him. Now, that's a common ordinary third-class flea's gait, but you take an Italian first-class that's been the pet of the nobility all his life and hasn't ever knowed what want or sickness or exposure was, and he can jump more than 300 times his own length and keep it up all day, 5 such jumps every second, which is 1,500 times his own length. Well, suppose a man could go 1,500 times his own length in a second. Say, 1.5 miles. It's 90 miles a minute. It's considerable more than 5,000 miles an hour. Where's your man now? Yes, and your bird and your railroad and your balloon. Laws, they don't amount to shucks alongside of a flea. A flea is just a comet biled down small. Jim was a good deal astonished, and so was I. Jim said,
"Is dem figures just exactly true, and no joking and no lies, Mars Tom?"
"Yes, they are. they're perfectly true.
Well, then, honey, a body's got to respect a flea. I ain't had no respect for 'em before, scarcely, but they ain't no getting round it. They do deserve it, that's certain.
Well, I bet they do. They've got ever so much more sense and brains and brightness in proportion to their size than any other critter in the world. A person can learn them most anything, and they learn it quicker than any other critter, too. They've been learnt to haul little carriages and harness, and go this way and that way and t'other way according to their orders. Yes, and to march and drill like soldiers, doing it as exact according to orders as soldiers does it. They've been learnt to do all sorts of hard and troublesome things. Suppose you could cultivate a flea up to the size of a man, and keep his natural smartness a-growing and a-growing right along up, bigger and bigger and keener in the same proportion, where'd the human race be, do you reckon? That flea would be President of the United States, and you couldn't any more prevent it than you can prevent lightning.
My land, Mars Tom, I never knowed there was so much to the beast. No, sir, I never had no idea of it, and that's the fact.
There's more to him by a long sight than there is to any other critter, man or beast, in proportion to size. He's the interestingest of them all. People have so much to say about an ant's strength and an elephant's and a locomotive's. Shucks, they don't begin with a flea. He can lift 200 or 300 times his own weight, and none of 'em can come anywhere near it. And, moreover, he has got notions of his own, and is very particular, and you can't fool him. His instinct, or his judgment, or whatever it is perfectly sound and clear, and don't ever make a mistake. People think all humans are alike to a flea. It ain't so. There's folks that he won't go near, hungry or not hungry, and I'm one of them. I've never had one of them on me in my life.
Mars Tom.
It's so? I ain't joking.
Well, sir, I ain't ever heard the likes of that before.
Jim couldn't believe it, and I couldn't, so we had to drop down to the sand and get a supply and see. Tom was right. They went for me and Jim by the thousand, but not a one of them lit on Tom. There weren't no explaining it, but there it was, and there weren't no getting around it. He said it had always been just so, and he'd just as soon be where there was a million of them as not. They'd never touch him nor bother him. We went up to the cold weather to freeze him out, and stayed a little spell, and then come back to the comfortable weather, and went lazing along 20 or 25 miles an hour, the way we'd been doing for the last few hours. The reason was that the longer we was in that solemn, peaceful desert, the more the hurry and fuss got kind of soothed down in us, and the more happier and contented and satisfied we got to feeling, and the more we got to liking the desert, and then loving it. So we had cramped the speed down, as I was saying, and was having a most noble good lazy time, sometimes watching through the glasses, sometimes stretched out on the lockers, reading, sometimes taking a nap. It didn't seem like we was the same lot that was in such a state to find land and get ashore, but it was. But we had got over that, clean over it. We was used to the balloon now and not afraid any more, and didn't want to be anywheres else. Why, it seemed just like home. It most seemed as if I had been born and raised in it, and Jim and Tom said the same. And always I had had hateful people around me, and nagging at me, and pestering of me, and scolding, and finding fault, and fussing and bothering, and sticking to me, and keeping after me, and making me do this, and making me do that, and t'other, and always selecting out the things I didn't want to do, and then giving me Sam Hill because I shirked and done something else, and just aggravating the life out of a body all the time. But up here in the sky it was so still and sunshiny and lovely, and plenty to eat, and plenty of sleep, and strange things to see, and no nagging, and no pestering, and no good people, and just holiday all the time. Land, I weren't in no hurry to get out and buck at civilization again. Now, one of the worst things about civilization is that anybody that gets a letter with trouble in it comes and tells you all about it and makes you feel bad, and the newspapers fetches you the troubles of everybody all over the world and keeps you downhearted and dismal most all the time, and it's such a heavy load for a person. I hate them newspapers, and I hate letters, and if I had my way I wouldn't allow nobody to load his troubles on to other folks he ain't acquainted with on t'other side of the world that way. Well, up in a balloon there ain't any of that. and it's the darlingest place there is. We had supper, and that night was one of the prettiest nights I ever see. The moon made it just like daylight, only a heap softer. And once we see a lion standing all alone by himself, just all alone on the earth, it seemed like, and his shadow laid on the sand by him like a puddle of ink. That's the kind of moonlight to have. Mainly we laid on our backs and talked. We didn't want to go to sleep. Tom said we was right in the midst of the Arabian Nights now. He said it was right along here that one of the cutest things in that book happened. So we looked down and watched while he told about it, because there ain't anything that is so interesting to look at as a place that a book has talked about. It was a tale about a camel driver that had lost his camel, and he come along in the desert and met a man and says, "Have you run across a stray camel today?" And the man says, "Was he blind in his left eye?" "Yes." "Had he lost an upper front tooth?" "Yes." "Was his off hind leg lame?" "Yes." "Was he loaded with millet seed on one side and honey on the other?" "Yes, but you needn't go into no more details. That's the one, and I'm in a hurry. Where did you see him?" "I ain't seen him at all," the man says. "Ain't seen him at all? How can you describe him so close, then?" "Because when a person knows how to use his eyes, everything has got a meaning to it. But most people's eyes ain't any good to them. I knowed a camel had been along because I seen his track. I knowed he was lame in his off hind leg because he had favored that foot and trod light on it, and his track showed it. I knowed he was blind on his left side because he only nibbled the grass on the right side of the trail. I knowed he had lost an upper front tooth because where he bit into the sod his teeth print showed it. The millet seed sifted out on one side, the ants told me that. The honey leaked out on the other, the flies told me that. I know all about your camel, but I ain't seen him." Jim says,
"Go on, Mars Tom, it's mighty good tale and powerful interestin'."
"That's all," Tom says.
"All?" says Jim, astonished. "What come of the camel?"
"I don't know."
"Mars Tom, don't the tale say?"
"No." Jim puzzled a minute, then he says,
"Well, if that ain't the beatenest tale ever I struck. It just gets to the place where the interest is getting red-hot and down she breaks. Why, Mars Tom, there ain't no sense in a tale that acts like that. Ain't you got no idea whether the man got the camel back or not?"
"No, I haven't." I see myself there weren't no sense in the tale to chop square off that way before it come to anything, but I weren't going to say so, because I could see Tom was souring up pretty fast over the way it flattened out and the way Jim had popped on to the weak place in it, and I don't think it's fair for everybody to pile on to a feller when he's down. But Tom, he whirls on me and says, "What do you think of the tale?" Of course, then I had to come out and make a clean breast and say it did seem to me, too, same as it did to Jim, that as long as the tale stopped square in the middle and never got to no place, it really weren't worth the trouble of telling. Tom's chin dropped on his breast, and instead of being mad, as I reckoned he'd be, to hear me scoff at his tale that way, he seemed to be only sad, and he says, "Some people can see, and some can't, just as that man said, let alone a camel. If a cyclone had gone by, you duffers wouldn't have noticed the track." I don't know what he meant by that, and he didn't say. It was just one of his irrelevances, I reckon. He was full of them sometimes, when he was in a close place and couldn't see no other way out. But I didn't mind. We'd spotted the soft place in that tale sharp enough, and he couldn't get away from that little fact. It graveled him like the nation, too, I reckon, much as he tried not to let on.
End of chapter 7. This is chapter 8 of Tom Sawyer Abroad. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Tom Sawyer Abroad by Mark Twain. Chapter 8, The Disappearing Lake.
We had an early breakfast in the morning, and sat looking down on the desert, and the weather was ever so balmy and lovely, although we weren't high up. You have to come down lower and lower after sundown in the desert, because it cools off so fast. And so, by the time it is getting toward dawn, you are skimming along only a little ways above the sand. We was watching the shadow of the balloon slide along the ground, and now and then gazing off across the desert to see if anything was stirring, and then down on the shadow again, when all of a sudden, almost right under us, we see a lot of men and camels laying scattered about, perfectly quiet, like they was asleep. We shut off the power, and backed up and stood over them, and then we see that they was all dead. It give us the cold shivers, and made us hush down, too, and talk low, like people at a funeral. We dropped down slow and stopped. There was men and women and children. They was dried by the sun and dark and shriveled and leathery, like the pictures of mummies you see in books. And yet they looked just as human. You wouldn't have believed it, just like they was asleep. Some of the people and animals was partly covered with sand, but most of them not, for the sand was thin there, and the bed was gravel and hard. Most of the clothes had rotted away, and when you took hold of a rag, it tore with a touch, like spiderweb. Tom reckoned they had been laying there for years. Some of the men had rusty guns by them. Some had swords on and had shawl belts with long, silver-mounted pistols stuck in them. All the camels had their loads on yet, but the packs had busted or rotted and spilt the freight out on the ground. We didn't reckon the swords was any good to the dead people any more, so we took one apiece and some pistols. We took a small box, too, because it was so handsome and inlaid so fine. And then we wanted to bury the people, but there weren't no way to do it that we could think of, and nothing to do it with but sand, and that would blow away again, of course. Then we mounted high and sailed away, and pretty soon that black spot on the sand was out of sight, and we wouldn't ever see them poor people again in this world. We wondered and reasoned and tried to guess how they come to be there, and how it all happened to them, but we couldn't make it out. First we thought maybe they got lost and wandered around and about till their food and water give out, and they starved to death. But Tom said no wild animals nor vultures hadn't meddled with them, and so that guess wouldn't do. So at last we give it up, and judged we wouldn't think about it no more, because it made us low-spirited. Then we opened the box, and it had gems and jewels in it, quite a pile, and some little veils of the kind the dead women had on, with fringes made out of curious gold money that we weren't acquainted with. We wondered if we better go and try to find them again and give it back, but Tom thought it over and said no, it was a country that was full of robbers, and they would come and steal it, and then the sin would be on us for putting the temptation in their way. So we went on. But I wished we had took all they had, so there wouldn't have been no temptation at all left. We had had 2 hours of that blazing weather down there, and was dreadful thirsty when we got aboard again. We went straight for the water, but it was spoiled and bitter, besides being pretty near hot enough to scald your mouth. We couldn't drink it. It was Mississippi River water, the best in the world, and we stirred up the mud in it to see if that would help, but no, the mud wasn't any better than the water. Well, we hadn't been so very, very thirsty before, whilst we was interested in the lost people, but we was now, and as soon as we found we couldn't have a drink, we was more than 35 times as thirsty as we was a quarter of a minute before. Why, in a little while we wanted to hold our mouths open and pant like a dog. Tom said to keep a sharp lookout all around, everywheres, because we'd got to find an oasis, or there weren't no telling what would happen. So we done it. We kept the glasses gliding around all the time till our arms got so tired we couldn't hold them any more. 2 hours, 3 hours, just gazing and gazing, and nothing but sand, 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 and you could see the quivering heat shimmer playing over it. Dear, dear, a body don't know what real misery is till he is thirsty all the way through and is certain he ain't ever going to come to any water any more. At last I couldn't stand it to look around on them baking plains. I laid down on the locker and give it up. But by and by Tom raised a whoop, and there she was, a lake, wide and shiny, with palm trees leaning over to sleep, and their shadders in the water just as soft and delicate as ever you see. I never see anything look so good. It was a long ways off, but that warn't anything to us. We just slapped on a 100-mile gait and calculated to be there in 7 minutes, but she stayed the same old distance away all the time. We couldn't seem to gain on her. Yes, sir, just as far, and shiny, and like a dream. but we couldn't get no nearer, and at last, all of a sudden, she was gone. Tom's eyes took a spread, and he says, "Boys, it was a mirage." Said it like he was glad. I didn't see nothing to be glad about. I says, "Maybe. I don't care nothing about its name. The thing I want to know is, what's become of it?" Jim was trembling all over, and so scared he couldn't speak, but he wanted to ask that question himself, if he could have done it. Tom says, "What's become of it? Why, you see yourself, it's gone." "Yes, I know, but where's it gone to?" He looked me over and says, "Well, now, Huck Finn, where would it go to? Don't you know what a mirage is?" "No, I don't. What is it?" "It ain't anything but imagination. There ain't anything to it." It warmed me up a little to hear him talk like that, and I says, "What's the use you talking that kind of stuff, Tom Sawyer? Didn't I see the lake?" "Yes, you think you did." "I don't think nothing about it. I did see it." "I tell you, you didn't see it either, because it weren't there to see." It astonished Jim to hear him talk so, and he broke in and says, kind of pleading and distressed, "Mars Tom, please don't say such things in such an awful time as this. You ain't only risking your own self, but you's a-risking us. Same way like Ananias and Sephra. The lake was dark. I seen it just as plain as I sees you and Huck this minute." I says, "Why, he seen it himself. He was the very one that seen it first. Now then."
"Yes, Mars Tom, it's so. You can't deny it. We all seen it, and that prove it was dare."
"Proves it? How does it prove it?"
"Same way it does in the courts and everywhere, Mars Tom. One person might be drunk or dreamy or something, and he could be mistaken. And two might, maybe. But I tell you, sir, when three sees a thing drunk or sober, it's so. They ain't no getting round dat, and you knows it, Mars Tom."
"I don't know nothing of the kind. There used to be 40,000 million people that seen the sun move from one side of the sky to the other every day. Did that prove that the sun done it?"
"Course it did. And besides, they weren't no occasion to prove it. A body that's got any sense ain't going to doubt it. There she is now, sailing through the sky, like she always done."
Tom turned to me then and says, "What do you say? Is the sun standing still?" "Tom Sawyer, what's the use to ask such a jackass question? Anybody who ain't blind can see it don't stand still." "Well," he says, "I'm lost in the sky with no company but a passel of low-down animals that don't know no more than the head boss of a university did 300 or 400 years ago." It warn't fair play, and I let him know it. I says, "Throwing mud ain't arguing, Tom Sawyer."
"Oh, my goodness, oh, my goodness gracious, there's the lake again,"
yelled Jim just then.
"Now, Mars Tom, what you going to say?"
"Yes, sir, there was the lake again, away yonder across the desert, perfectly plain, trees and all, just the same as it was before." I says, "I reckon you're satisfied now, Tom Sawyer." But he says, perfectly calm, "Yes, satisfied there ain't no lake there." Jim says,
"Don't talk so, Mars Tom. It scares me to hear you. It's so hot and you's so thirsty that you ain't in your right mind, Mars Tom. Oh, but don't she look good?
Clare, I don't know how I's going to wait till we gets there. I's so thirsty." "Well, you'll have to wait, and it won't do you no good either, because there ain't no lake there, I tell you." I says, "Jim, don't you take your eye off of it, and I won't either."
"'Deed, I won't. And bless you, honey, I couldn't if I wanted to."
We went a-tearing along toward it, piling the miles behind us like nothing, but never gaining an inch on it, and all of a sudden, it was gone again. Jim staggered and most fell down. When he got his breath, he says, gasping like a fish,
"Mars Tom, it's a ghost, that's what it is, and I hopes to goodness we ain't going to see it no more. There's been a lake, and something's happened, and the lake's dead, and we seen its ghost. We seen it twice, and that's proof. The desert's haunted. It's haunted, sure. Oh, Mars Tom, let's get out in it. I'd rather die than have the night catch us in it again, and the ghost or that lake come a-mourning around us, and we asleep and don't know the danger we's in."
"Ghost, you gander! It ain't anything but air and heat and thirstiness pasted together by a person's imagination. If I—give me the glass." He grabbed it, and begun to gaze off to the right. "It's a flock of birds," he says. "It's getting toward sundown, and they're making a beeline across our track for somewheres. They mean business. Maybe they're going for food or water, or both. Let her go to starboard. Port your helm. Hard down. There, ease up. Steady as you go." We shut down some of the power, so as not to outspeed them, and took out after them. We went skimming along a quarter of a mile behind them, and when we had followed them an hour and a half and was getting pretty discouraged and was thirsty clean to unendurableness, Tom says, "Take the glass, one of you, and see what that is, away ahead of the birds." Jim got the first glimpse and slumped down on the locker sick. He was most crying, and says,
"She's dead again, Mars Tom. She's dead again, and I knows I's gwine to die, 'cause when a body sees a ghost a third time, that's what it means. I wish I'd never come in dis balloon, dat I does."
He wouldn't look no more, and what he said made me afraid, too, because I knowed it was true, for that has always been the way with ghosts. So then I wouldn't look any more either. Both of us begged Tom to turn off and go some other way, but he wouldn't. He said we was ignorant, superstitious blatherskites. "Yes, and he'll get come up with one of these days," I says to myself, "insulting ghosts that way. They'll stand it for a while, maybe, but they won't stand it always, for anybody that knows about ghosts knows how easy they are hurt and how revengeful they are." So we was all quiet and still, Jim and me being scared and Tom busy. By and by Tom fetched the balloon to a standstill and says, "Now get up and look, you sapheads." We done it, and there was the sure enough water right under us, clear and blue and cool and deep and wavy with a breeze, the loveliest sight that ever was, and all about it was grassy banks and flowers and shady groves of big trees looped together with vines, and all looking so peaceful and comfortable, enough to make a body cry. It was so beautiful. Jim did cry, and rip and dance and carry on, he was so thankful and out of his mind for joy. It was my watch, so I had to stay by the works, but Tom and Jim clumbed down and drunk a barrel apiece, and fetched me up a lot, and I've tasted a many good thing in my life, but nothing that ever begun with that water. Then we went down and had a swim, and then Tom came up and spelled me, and me and Jim had a swim, and then Jim spelled Tom, and me and Tom had a foot race and a boxing mill, and I don't reckon I ever had such a good time in my life. It weren't so very hot, because it was close on to evening, and we hadn't any clothes on anyway. Clothes is well enough in school, and in towns, and at balls, too, but there ain't no sense in them when there ain't no civilization, nor other kinds of bothers and fussiness around.
"Lions coming, lions! Quick, Mars Tom! Jump for your life, Huck!"
Oh, and didn't we? We never stopped for clothes, but waltzed up the ladder just so. Jim lost his head straight off. He always done it whenever he got excited and scared. And so now, instead of just easing the ladder up from the ground a little, so the animals couldn't reach it, he turned on a raft of power, and we went whizzing up and was dangling in the sky before he got his wits together and seen what a foolish thing he was doing. Then he stopped her, but he had clean forgot what to do next. So there we was, so high that the lions looked like pups, and we was drifting off on the wind. But Tom, he shinned up and went for the works and begun to slant her down and back toward the lake where the animals was gathering like a camp meeting, and I judged he had lost his mind, too, for he knowed I was too scared to climb, and did he want to dump me among the tigers and things? But no, his head was level. He knowed what he was about. He swooped down to within 30 or 40 feet of the lake and stopped right over the center and sung out, "Leggo and drop!" I done it, and shot down feet first, and seemed to go about a mile toward the bottom, and when I come up, he says, "Now, lay on your back and float till you're rested and got your pluck back. Then I'll dip the ladder in the water, and you can climb aboard." I done it. Now that was ever so smart in Tom, because if he had started off somewheres else to drop down on the sand, the menagerie would have come along, too, and might have kept us hunting a safe place till I got tuckered out and fell. And all this time the lions and tigers was sorting out the clothes and trying to divide them up so there would be some for all, but there was a misunderstanding about it somewheres on account of some of them trying to hog more than their share. So there was another insurrection, and you never see anything like it in the world. There must have been 50 of them, all mixed up together, snorting and roaring and snapping and biting and tearing, legs and tails in the air, and you couldn't tell which was which, and the sand and fur a-flying. And when they got done, some was dead, and some was limping off crippled, and the rest was setting around on the battlefield, some of them licking their sore places, and the others looking up at us and seemed to be kind of inviting us to come down and have some fun, but which we didn't want any. As for the clothes, they weren't any anymore. Every last rag of them was inside of the animals, and not agreeing with them very well, I don't reckon, for there was considerable many brass buttons on them, and there was knives in the pockets, too, and smoking tobacco, and nails, and chalk, and marbles, and fish-hooks and things. But I wasn't caring. All that was bothering me was that all we had now was the professor's clothes, a big enough assortment, but not suitable to go into company with, if we came across any, because the breeches was as long as tunnels, and the coats and things according. Still, there was everything a tailor needed, and Jim was a kind of jack-legged tailor, and he allowed he could soon trim a suit or two down for us that would answer.
End of chapter 8. This is Chapter 9 of Tom Sawyer Abroad. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Tom Sawyer Abroad by Mark Twain. Chapter 9. Tom Discourses on the Desert.
Still, we thought we would drop down there a minute, but on another errand. Most of the professor's cargo of food was put up in cans, in the new way that somebody had just invented. The rest was fresh. When you fetch Missouri beefsteak to the Great Sahara, you want to be particular and stay up in the coolish weather. So we reckoned we would drop down into the lion market and see how we could make out there. We hauled in the ladder and dropped down till we was just above the reach of the animals. Then we let down a rope with a slip-knot in it and hauled up a dead lion, a small, tender one, then yanked up a cub tiger. We had to keep the congregation off with a revolver, or they would have took a hand in the proceedings and helped. We carved off a supply from both and saved the skins and hove the rest overboard. Then we baited some of the professor's hooks with the fresh meat and went a-fishing. We stood over the lake just a convenient distance above the water and catched a lot of the nicest fish you ever see. It was a most amazing good supper we had. Lion steak, tiger steak, fried fish, and hot corn pone. I don't want nothing better than that. We had some fruit to finish off with. We got it out of the top of a monstrous tall tree. It was a very slim tree that hadn't a branch on it from the bottom plumb to the top, and there it bursted out like a feather duster. It was a palm tree, of course. Anybody knows a palm tree the minute he sees it, by the pictures. We went for coconuts in this one, but there weren't none. There was only big loose bunches of things like oversized grapes, and Tom allowed they was dates, because he said they answered the description in the Arabian Nights and the other books. Of course, they mightn't be, and they might be poison. So we had to wait a spell and watch and see if the birds at 'em. They done it, so we done it too. And they was most amazing good. By this time, monstrous big birds begun to come and settle on the dead animals. They was plucky critters. They would tackle one end of a lion that was being gnawed at the other end by another lion. If the lion drove the bird away, it didn't do no good. He was back again the minute the lion was busy. The big birds come out of every part of the sky. Tom said the birds didn't find out the meat was there by the smell. They had to find it out by seeing it. Oh, but ain't that an eye for you? Tom said at the distance of 5 miles, a patch of dead lions couldn't look any bigger than a person's fingernail, and he couldn't imagine how the birds could notice such a little thing so far off. It was strange and unnatural to see lion eat lion, and we thought maybe they weren't kin. But Jim said that didn't make no difference. He said a hog was fond of her own children, and so was a spider, and he reckoned maybe a lion was pretty near as unprincipled, though maybe not quite. He thought likely a lion wouldn't eat his own father, if he knowed which was him, but reckoned he would eat his brother-in-law, if he was uncommon hungry, and eat his mother-in-law any time. But reckoning don't settle nothing. You can reckon till the cows come home, but that don't fetch you to no decision. So we give it up and let it drop. Generally, it was very still in the desert nights, but this time there was music. A lot of other animals come to dinner, sneaking yelpers that Tom allowed was jackals, and roach-backed ones that he said was hyenas, and all the whole biling of them kept up a racket all the time. They made a picture in the moonlight that was more different than any picture I ever see. We had a line out and made fast to the top of a tree, and didn't stand no watch, but all turned in and slept. But I was up two or three times to look down at the animals and hear the music. It was like having a front seat at a menagerie for nothing, which I hadn't ever had before, and so it seemed foolish to sleep and not make the most of it. I mightn't ever have such a chance again. We went a-fishing again in the early dawn, and then lazied around all day in the deep shade on an island, taking turn about to watch and see that none of the animals come a-snooping around there after aeronauts for dinner. We was going to leave the next day, but couldn't. It was too lovely. The day after, when we rose up toward the sky and sailed off eastward, we looked back and watched that place till it weren't nothing but just a speck in the desert, and I tell you, it was like saying goodbye to a friend that you ain't ever going to see any more. Jim was thinking to himself, and at last he says,
"Mars Tom, we's most to de end of de desert now, I spec."
"Why?"
"Well, it stand to reason we is. You knows how long we's been a-skimming over it. Must be most out of sand. It's a wonder to me that it's hilt out as long as it has."
"Shuck, there's plenty sand. You needn't worry."
"Oh, I ain't a-worryin', Mars Tom, only wonderin', that's all. De Lord's got plenty of sand, I ain't doubtin' that. But nemmind, he ain't gwine to waste it just on dat account. And I allows dat dis desert's plenty big enough now, just de way she is, and you can't spread her out no more dout wastin' sand."
"Oh, go long. We ain't much more than fairly started across this desert yet. The United States is a pretty big country, ain't it? Ain't it, Huck?"
"Yes," I says.
"There ain't no bigger one, I don't reckon."
"Well," he says, "this desert is about the shape of the United States, and if you was to lay it down on top of the United States, it would cover the land of the free out of sight like a blanket. There'd be a little corner sticking out up at Maine and away up northwest, and Florida sticking out like a turtle's tail, and that's all. We've took California away from the Mexicans 2 or 3 years ago, so that part of the Pacific coast is ours now, and if you laid the Great Sahara down with her edge on the Pacific, she would cover the United States and stick out past New York 600 miles into the Atlantic Ocean."
I say, "Good land! Have you got the documents for that, Tom Sawyer?"
"Yes, and they're right here, and I've been studying them. You can look for yourself. From New York to the Pacific is 2,600 miles. From one end of the Great Desert to the other is 3,200. The United States contains 3,600,000 square miles. The desert contains 4,162,000. With the desert's bulk, you could cover up every last inch of the United States, and in under where the edges projected out, you could tuck England, Scotland, Ireland, France, Denmark, and all Germany. Yes, sir, you could hide the home of the brave and all of them countries clean out of sight under the Great Sahara, and you would still have 2,000 square miles of sand left."
"Well," I says, "it clean beats me. Why, Tom, it shows that the Lord took as much pains making this desert as making the United States and all them other countries."
Jim says, "Huck, that don't stand to reason. I reckon this desert wa'n't made at all. Now, you take and look at it like this. You look at it and see if I's right. What's a desert good for? 'Tain't good for nothing. 'Tain't no way to make it pay. Ain't that so, Huck?"
"Yes, I reckon."
"Ain't it so, Mars Tom?"
"I guess so. Go on."
"If a thing ain't no good, it's made in vain, ain't it?"
"Yes."
"Now then, do de Lord make anything in vain? You answer me that."
"Well, no, he don't."
"Then how come he make a desert?"
"Well, go on. How did he come to make it?"
"Mars Tom, I believe it is just like when you'd building a house. There's always a lot of truck and rubbish left over. What does you do with it? Don't you take and cart it off and dump it into an old vacant back lot?"
"Course."
"Now then, it's my opinion it was just like that, that the Great Sahara weren't made at all. She just happened."
I said it was a real good argument, and I believed it was the best one Jim ever made. Tom, he said the same, but said the trouble about arguments is they ain't nothing but theories, after all, and theories don't prove nothing. They only give you a place to rest on a spell when you are tuckered out butting around and around trying to find out something there ain't no way to find out. And he says, there's another trouble about theories. There's always a hole in them somewheres, sure, if you look close enough. It's just so with this one of Jim's. Look what billions and billions of stars there is. How does it come that there was just exactly enough star stuff and none left over? How does it come there ain't no sand pile up there? But Jim was fixed for him and says, what's the Milky Way? That's what I want to know. What's the Milky Way? Answer me that. In my opinion, it was just a sockdologer. It's only an opinion, it's only my opinion, and others may think different, but I said it then and I stand to it now. It was a sockdologer. And moreover, besides, it landed Tom Sawyer. He couldn't say a word. He had that stunned look of a person that's been shot in the back with a keg of nails. All he said was, as for people like me and Jim, he'd just as soon have intellectual intercourse with a catfish. But anybody can say that. And I notice they always do when somebody has fetched them a lifter. Tom Sawyer was tired of that end of the subject. So we got back to talking about the size of the desert again, and the more we compared it with this and that and t'other thing, the more nobler and bigger and grander it got to look right along. And so, hunting amongst the figures, Tom found, by and by, that it was just the same size as the Empire of China. Then he showed us the spread the Empire of China made on the map, and the room she took up in the world. Well, it was wonderful to think of. And I says, why, I've heard talk about this desert plenty of times, but I never knowed before how important she was. And Tom says, important. Sahara important. That's just the way with some people. If a thing's big, it's important. That's all the sense they've got. All they can see is size. Why, look at England. It's the most important country in the world. And yet, you could put it in China's vest pocket, and not only that, but you'd have the Dickens' own time to find it again the next time you wanted it. And look at Russia. It spreads all around and everywhere, and yet ain't no more important in this world than Rhode Island is, and hasn't got half as much in it that's worth saving. Away off now, we see a little hill standing up just on the edge of the world. Tom broke off his talk and reached for a glass very much excited and took a look and says, that's it. It's the one I've been looking for, sure. If I'm right, it's the one the dervish took the man into and showed him all the treasures. So we begun to gaze, and he begun to tell about it out of the Arabian Nights.
End of chapter 9.
This is chapter 10 of Tom Sawyer Abroad. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Tom Sawyer Abroad by Mark Twain, Chapter 10, The Treasure Hill.
Tom said it happened like this. A dervish was stumping it along through the desert on foot one blazing hot day, and he had come 1,000 miles, and was pretty poor and hungry and ornery and tired, and along about where we are now he run across a camel driver with 100 camels and asked him for some alms. But the camel driver, he asked to be excused. The dervish says, "Don't you own these camels?" "Yes, they're mine."
"Are you in debt?"
"Who, me? No."
"Well, a man that owns 100 camels and ain't in debt is rich, and not only rich, but very rich, ain't it so?"
The camel driver owned up that it was so. Then the dervish says,
"God has made you rich, and he has made me poor. He has his reasons, and they are wise, blessed be his name. But he has willed that his rich shall help his poor, and you have turned away from me, your brother, in my need. And he will remember this, and you will lose by it."
Now that made the camel driver feel shaky, but all the same he was born hoggish after money, and didn't like to let go a cent. So he begun to whine and explain, and said times was hard, and although he had took a full freight down to Balsora and got a fat rate for it, he couldn't get no return freight, so he weren't making no great things out of his trip. So the dervish starts along again and says,
"All right, if you want to take the risk, but I reckon you've made a mistake this time and missed the chance."
Of course, the camel driver wanted to know what kind of a chance he had missed, because maybe there was money in it. So he run after the dervish and begged him so hard and earnest to take pity on him that at last the dervish gave in and says,
"Do you see that hill yonder? Well, in that hill is all the treasures of the earth, and I was looking around for a man with a particular good kind heart and a noble generous disposition, because if I could find just that man, I've got a kind of a salve I could put on his eyes, and he could see the treasures and get them out."
So then the camel driver was in a sweat, and he cried and begged and took on and went down on his knees and said he was just that kind of a man, and said he could fetch 1,000 people that would say he wasn't ever described so exact before.
"Well, then," says the dervish, "all right, if we load the 100 camels, can I have half of them?"
The driver was so glad he couldn't hardly hold in, and says, "Now you're shouting." So they shook hands on the bargain, and the dervish got out his box and rubbed the salve on the driver's right eye, and the hill opened, and he went in, and there, sure enough, was piles and piles of gold and jewels, sparkling like all the stars in heaven had fell down. So him and the dervish laid into it, and they loaded every camel till he couldn't carry no more. Then they said good-bye, and each of them started off with his 50. But pretty soon the camel driver come a-running and overtook the dervish and says, "You ain't in society, you know, and you don't really need all you've got. Won't you be good and let me have 10 of your camels?"
"Well," the dervish says, "I don't know but what you say is reasonable enough."
So he done it, and they separated, and the dervish started off again with his 40. But pretty soon here comes the camel driver bawling after him again, and whines and slobbers around and begs another 10 off of him, saying 30 camel loads of treasure was enough to see a dervish through, because they live very simple, you know, and don't keep house, but board around and give their note. But that weren't the end yet. That ornery hound kept coming and coming till he had begged back all the camels and had the whole 100. Then he was satisfied and ever so grateful, and said he wouldn't ever forget the dervish as long as he lived, and nobody hadn't been so good to him before and liberal. So they shook hands goodbye and separated and started off again. But do you know, it weren't 10 minutes till the camel driver was unsatisfied again. He was the low-downest reptile in 7 counties, and he come a-running again. And this time the thing he wanted was to get the dervish to rub some of the salve on his other eye.
"Why?" said the dervish.
"Oh, you know," says the driver.
"Know what?"
"Well, you can't fool me," says the driver.
"You're trying to keep back something from me. You know it mighty well. You know, I reckon, that if I had the salve on the other eye, I could see a lot more things that's valuable. Come, please put it on."
The dervish says,
"I wasn't keeping anything back from you. I don't mind telling you what would happen if I put it on. You'd never see again. You'd be stone blind the rest of your days."
But do you know, that beat wouldn't believe him. No, he begged and begged, and whined and cried, till at last the dervish opened his box and told him to put it on if he wanted to. So the man done it, and sure enough he was as blind as a bat in a minute. Then the dervish laughed at him and mocked at him and made fun of him, and says,
"Goodbye. A man that's blind ain't got no use for jewelry."
And he cleared out with 100 camels, and left that man to wander round poor and miserable and friendless the rest of his days in the desert. Jim said he'd bet it was a lesson to him.
"Yes," Tom says,
"and like a considerable many lessons a body gets.
They ain't no account, because the thing don't ever happen the same way again, and can't. The time Hen Scoville fell down the chimbley and crippled his back for life, everybody said it would be a lesson to him. What kind of a lesson? How was he going to use it? He couldn't climb chimbleys no more, and he hadn't no more backs to break."
"All the same, Mars Tom, there is such a thing as learning by experience. And the good book said, 'The burnt child shunned the fire.'"
"Well, I ain't denying that a thing's a lesson if it's a thing that can happen twice just the same way. There's lots of such things, and they educate a person. That's what Uncle Abner always said.
But there's 40 million lots of the other kind, the kind that don't happen the same way twice, and they ain't no real use. They ain't no more instructive than the smallpox. When you've got it, it ain't no good to find out you ought to been vaccinated, and ain't no good to get vaccinated afterward, because the smallpox don't come but once. But on the other hand, Uncle Abner said that the person that had took a bull by the tail once had learnt 60 or 70 times as much as a person that hadn't, and said a person that started in to carry a cat home by the tail was getting knowledge that was always going to be useful to him and weren't ever going to grow dim or doubtful. But I can tell you, Jim, Uncle Abner was down on them people that's all the time trying to dig a lesson out of everything that happens, no matter whether. But Jim was asleep. Tom looked kind of ashamed, because you know a person always feels bad when he's talking uncommon fine and thinks the other person is admiring, and that other person goes to sleep that way. Of course, he oughtn't to go to sleep because it's shabby, but the finer a person talks, the certainer it is to make you sleep, and so when you come to look at it, it ain't nobody's fault in particular. Both of them's to blame. Jim began to snore. Soft and blubbery at first, then a long rasp, then a stronger one, then a half a dozen horrible ones, like the last water sucking down the plug hole of a bathtub, then the same with more power to it, and some big coughs and snorts flung in, the way a cow does that is choking to death. And when the person has got to that point, he is at his level best, and can wake up a man that is in the next block with a dipper full of laudanum in him, but can't wake himself up, although all that awful noise of his'n ain't but 3 inches from his own ears. And that is the curious thing in the world, seems to me. But you rake a match to light the candle, and that little bit of a noise will fetch him. I wish I knowed what was the reason of that, but there don't seem to be no way to find out. Now there was Jim alarming the whole desert and yanking the animals out for miles and miles around to see what in the nation was going on up there. There weren't nobody nor nothing that was as close to the noise as he was, and yet he was the only critter that wasn't disturbed by it. We yelled at him and whooped at him. It never done no good. But the first time there come a little wee noise that wasn't of a usual kind, it woke him up. No, sir, I've thought it all over, and so has Tom. And there ain't no way to find out why a snorer can't hear himself snore. Jim said he hadn't been asleep. He just shut his eyes so he could listen better. Tom said nobody weren't accusing him. That made him look like he wished he hadn't said anything, and he wanted to get away from the subject, I reckon, because he begun to abuse the camel driver just the way a person does when he has got catched in something and wants to take it out of somebody else. He let into the camel driver the hardest he knowed how, and I had to agree with him, and he praised up the dervish the highest he could, and I had to agree with him there, too. But Tom says, "I ain't so sure. You call that dervish so dreadful liberal and good and unselfish, but I don't quite see it. He didn't hunt up another poor dervish, did he? No, he didn't. If he was so unselfish, why didn't he go in there himself and take a pocket full of jewels and go along and be satisfied? No, sir, the person he was hunting for was a man with 100 camels. He wanted to get away with all the treasure he could."
"Why, Mars Tom, he was willing to divide fair and square. He only struck for 50 camels."
"Because he knowed how he was going to get all of them by and by."
"Mars Tom, he told the man the truck would make him blind."
"Yes, because he knowed the man's character. It was just the kind of a man he was hunting for. A man that never believes in anybody's word or anybody's honorableness, because he ain't got none of his own. I reckon there's lots of people like that dervish. They swindle right and left, but they always make the other person seem to swindle himself. They keep inside of the letter of the law all the time, and there ain't no way to get hold of them. They don't put the salve on. Oh, no, that would be sin. But they know how to fool you into putting it on. Then it's you that blinds yourself. I reckon the dervish and the camel driver was just a pair, a fine, smart, brainy rascal, and a dull, coarse, ignorant one, but both of them rascals just the same."
"Mars Tom, does you reckon dey's any of dat kind of salve in the world now?"
"Yes, Uncle Abner says there is. He says they've got it in New York, and they put it on country people's eyes, and show them all the railroads in the world, and they go in and get them,
and then, when they rub the salve on the other eye, the other man bids them good-bye and goes off with their railroads. Here's the Treasure Hill now. Lower away. We landed, but it weren't as interesting as I thought it was going to be, because we couldn't find the place where they went in to get the treasure. Still, it was plenty interesting enough, just to see the mere hill itself where such a wonderful thing happened. Jim said he wouldn't have missed it for $3, and I felt the same way. And to me and Jim, as wonderful a thing as any, was the way Tom could come into a strange big country like this and go straight and find a little hump like that, and tell it in a minute from a million other humps that was almost just like it, and nothing to help him but only his own learning and his own natural smartness. We talked and talked it over together, but couldn't make out how he'd done it. He had the best head on him I ever see, and all he lacked was age to make a name for himself equal to Captain Kidd or George Washington. I bet you it would have crowded either of them to find that hill with all their gifts, but it weren't nothing to Tom Sawyer. He went across Sahara and put his finger on it as easy as you could pick a nigger out of a bunch of angels. We found a pond of salt water close by and scraped up a raft of salt around the edges and loaded up the lion's skin and the tiger's so as they would keep till Jim could tan them. End of chapter 10.
Why is life better with American Family Insurance? Because every policy comes with something very special. A trusted agent who's there to help protect your dreams by finding the right coverage at the right price. Save up to 23% when you bundle home and auto. American Family Insurance. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.